As many Texans face economic hardship, a new study shows a growing trend toward taking debtors to court. That story and a whole lot more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Anyone else ready for a haircut? Are you sure? As the governor relaxes orders to keep salons and barbershops closed, concerns about reopening on Friday. Dr. Fred Campbell of UT Health San Antonio taking on more listener questions about COVID-19. Higher ed students finishing studies for the year, though many can't go home. Also, Omar Gallego with the scoop on scooters hitting Texas-sized potholes, plus a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this seventh day of May, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Thursday. Those days of the week run together. You know it's a Thursday when you hear the day's top stories from the Labor Department again. Thursday weekly unemployment data is out, and another 3 million people have filed jobless claims, bringing to 33 million the total number of claims filed in the last 7 weeks alone. Tomorrow, the monthly jobs report will be released, and economists expect it to show the rate for April at 15%, levels last seen in the Great Depression, and it is almost certainly going to be an understatement of the actual damage. A big development for those collecting unemployment in Texas: the state plans to reinstate work search requirements once stores and restaurants are allowed to open to 50% capacity. That, according to the Texas Tribune. Even before coronavirus drove more than 2 million Texans into unemployment, a new study just released by the Pew Charitable Trusts shows debt collection lawsuits surging in Texas, doubling between 2014 and 2018. KERA's Christopher Connolly has more.
In 2018, debt collection lawsuits were the most common kind of case filed in Texas civil courts. They accounted for more than one in four cases. Researcher Erica Ricard from Pew says most of these lawsuits are for debts of less than $5,000.
These are generally businesses represented by attorneys who are suing individuals for private student loan debt, credit card debt, medical debt.
The vast majority of people being sued by debt collectors don't have lawyers. And about 70% of the time, defendants don't even show up to court. So debt collectors win by default. And that means
the court does not review whether the defendant knew about the case, whether the plaintiff has a valid debt to begin with, whether they're suing the right person for the right amount, whether that case was brought in a timely manner.
That can have costly consequences for the defendant and, Ricard says, for the public.
Routinely order court costs, attorney's fees, and accrued interest on debt collection lawsuits. And they also open up another avenue of debt collection. And this is where we get to the kinds of freezing of bank accounts and garnishing of wages that is a kind of court-enforced collection of a private debt.
With so many people in financial hardship right now, she says it's likely debt collection lawsuits will continue to increase. In Fort Worth, I'm Christopher Connolly for the Texas Standard.
It's that time once again for your questions about COVID-19. We've been asking you to send whatever question you have about the pandemic to us, and we'll get them answered with Dr. Fred Campbell. He is a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for coming back to speak with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate all your assistance.
Well, it's great to be back, David.
This first question was sent to us by Shreyas Krishnan through texasstandard.org/coronavirus. Shreyas asks, do you have any tips, doctor, on persuading someone who believes they won't get sick and isn't following recommended guidelines to modify their behavior?
I have to be very frank with you, David, and mention that, in fact, the president has declared war on COVID-19, and in a situation where this virus has been killing tens of thousands of our fellow Americans and people around the country, I think people really must consider the consequences of their behavior. I mean, people can decide just what the level of giving aid and comfort in a situation like this to our enemy, the COVID-19, and that's something that I think everyone should be dead serious about.
life in wartime. This question was submitted through our website by Natalie Watkins. She wants to know, in terms of COVID-19, is there any benefit to taking zinc supplements to boost immune function, and is it safe to do so?
So-called experts have been touting the benefits of a number of treatments and preventatives over the last several months. This, in my opinion, has been reckless and sometimes likely to have resulted in excess deaths. Now, there are some benefits, we think, to recent drugs that have been tested in a systematic fashion, and that's very encouraging. To my knowledge, zinc is not one of those agents, and I think those drugs, until they're tested systematically, could give a lot of people a false sense of security.
So you're saying that the danger here is not so much from the supplements themselves, but from that false sense of security?
That's correct. For the most part, these are unproven. And so even though it may not be dangerous, it certainly is not the wisest idea.
This is a question we've been seeing asked in various ways across social media in the past several days, especially as sectors of the Texas economy have started to be reopened. Texas is seeing an increase in COVID-19 cases, but also in tests for the virus. How do you assess the current trends you're seeing when it comes to mitigating spread of the virus and flattening the curve?
Well, I believe, in my opinion, the almost complete reason for the mitigation of this virus and the flattening of the curve has been due to following recommended hygiene measures and physical distancing. Testing has been helpful in very, very limited cases. Unfortunately, testing capability, I believe, has not been addressed seriously at the highest levels of government. Until it is, it's going to be very, very dangerous for people to be out. Eventually, it's possible that every American will need to be tested as often as weekly until we can find an effective treatment or vaccine.
This next question comes from Karen Elvona, who submitted this through our website, texasstandard.org. She writes, when are people who have the virus but are asymptomatic no longer contagious?
Experts are recommending that anyone who may be positive for COVID or even has a syndrome that may be consistent with COVID-19 quarantine themselves for 14 days.
So that's if you're asymptomatic but no longer contagious and you've been identified with the virus, so 14 days. Now, are we any closer to an answer to the question of whether or not people who have been diagnosed with coronavirus, they've gone through COVID-19 and then they've come out the other side, is it clear whether they can get the coronavirus again?
Unfortunately not. Eventually, we will be able to differentiate the antibodies that are produced in an infection of this sort, and neutralizing antibodies, for instance, could be determined, and those would be much more likely to be conferring immunity.
Dr. Campbell, something that I'd like to have a little clarity on. You know, when the governor says that he is lifting some of the restrictions in phases, he's not ordering people to go out to eat at dinner at a restaurant. He's not saying that businesses have to reopen. He seems to be sort of suggesting that it's okay if those who choose to do so under these particular guidelines, you know, 25% seating, that sort of thing, and maintaining social distance. So what I'm curious about is, in the conversation about what the governor is doing, doesn't this ultimately come down to personal responsibility, or how do you see it?
It's clear that trying to follow distancing and other hygiene measures has been helpful in the past. At this stage, when more and more social congregation is occurring due to these recent loosening of recommendations, I believe that it's, again, a very, very dangerous situation and one that could result in another spike of COVID-19 infections.
Well, speaking of the loosening of the recommendations, on Friday, I believe barbers and salons will be allowed to reopen their doors in certain situations. Is it safe to get a haircut? A lot of people want one.
think this has to be an individual decision. However, in my own personal opinion, it would seem that would be a very dangerous undertaking at the present time until we're certain that we have other mitigating techniques, such as perhaps preventatives and vaccines that are effective.
Is there anything that you would look for if you were going to go out and get a haircut? Is there something that you would look for from someone willing to provide that service?
Well, certainly if we got to the point where we could have frequent and accurate testing, then it would be much more likely that these kinds of services and activities would be safe. We are far from that at the present time, and that is the most disturbing thing, is our inadequacy to test effectively and frequently at the present time.
So assurances that they're sanitizing all instruments, that the floors are clean, that they're wearing masks, wearing gloves, all of that, that's not sufficient?
All of those techniques are better than nothing at all, but none of them can be guarantees of avoidance of transmission of COVID-19.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School of Medicine at UT Health San Antonio. We're having him on regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions, dear listeners. And if you have something that you'd like to ask Dr. Campbell, you can look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for speaking with us again and clearing some things up.
Thank you, David. It's always a privilege.
Wells Dunbar monitoring the talk of Texas on this Thursday. Hello there, Wells.
Hi, David. Well, the White House has apparently shelved a Centers for Disease Control document with step-by-step advice to local leaders on when and how to reopen public places amid COVID-19. The story, unexclusive from the Associated Press, trending on Twitter. One CDC researcher quoted says they were told the recommendations, which are far more specific than vaguer guidelines from the Trump administration, would, quote, never see the light of day. On our Facebook page, Joshua Schimberg writes that by the end of May, there will be well over 100,000 dead Americans from COVID-19, and there will be few signs of that stopping, thanks to the leadership of our federal government. One of the provocative responses we're seeing out there, David. That's just one story we're tracking. I'll be back with more later in the show.
Yeah, if you're in North Texas, you need to be aware of a line of storms that may be rolling in tonight sometime as the sun is going down. Could get rather strong overnight as well. Keep it here on this station for the very latest. Wells Dunbar, back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In just over 2 weeks, COVID-19 cases have quadrupled in Texas immigrant detention centers. Many of those cases can be traced back to transfers of immigrants from county jails to federal holding facilities in the state and elsewhere. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall tracks how the illness can make its way from one facility to another as she follows one man's journey from Houston to Livingston.
Hope isn't sure when she'll see her boyfriend again. They've been a couple for 5 years and were raising their son together in Houston.
I say it's going to take a long time before we meet with dad again.
He's in lockup now after an argument got physical back in March. He was first taken to Harris County Jail, where he was held for about 6 weeks, right when COVID-19 began to spread.
He was placed on quarantine himself, like him and whatever floor he was on, because they had a positive inmate.
Hope tried to bail him out, but immigration officials ordered her boyfriend be transferred to one of their facilities for deportation. He came to the U.S. from Mexico as a kid without authorization. That's why Hope asked we keep their identities anonymous. Officials drove her boyfriend 70 miles northeast of Houston to an immigration detention center in Livingston.
Once he got into ICE, he struck a 104.1 fever, and he had the symptoms, but they did not test him.
He told her he was feeling sick and had to share a room with at least two other men before I separated him from other detainees. So if he had COVID-19, he could have easily spread it. But he doesn't know because he was never tested. Still, ICE confirmed they can trace their first positive COVID-19 case at their Livingston facility back to the Harris County Jail. Now Livingston has at least 9 positive cases. This is one way COVID-19 is spreading to immigrant detention centers, but the spread is also coming from facilities in other states.
Instead of them releasing people, they transferred them across the country.
Shauna McLean is an immigration lawyer in New York. Her client, Bazaa Jalili, had been detained in upstate New York where officials were trying to contain a COVID-19 outbreak when suddenly...
Well, I was notified, but I was notified after the decision was made on a Friday night at about 8:45 or 9 o'clock or something by email. And it was simply just a transfer notification.
Overnight, her client and other detainees were transferred from New York to a detention center 30 miles south of Fort Worth, a facility that quickly became a hotbed for infection. They went from 0 cases to now at least 42, more cases than any other ICE facility in Texas. The disease is also crossing international borders. Authorities in Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, have traced more than a dozen COVID-19 cases at a migrant shelter there back to a man who was deported from the Houston area.
You really shouldn't be transferring people between facilities if you have any positives.
Dr. Donna Kim Murphy has been demanding the release of people from detention since the outbreak started. Murphy is a neurologist and immigrant health advocate. She says someone can carry the virus for 2 weeks without showing symptoms, and others never show symptoms, so authorities can never really safely transfer any detainee who has been exposed to the disease.
With people who are constantly transferred between facilities, new people who are entering facilities, the staff who are actually traveling between facilities, it's very likely that you will have, at some point, the introduction of the infection into these populations, which then are kind of like tinderboxes.
Murphy says if it remains business as usual in these facilities, we'll see the disease continue to spread. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. A year or so ago, Texas cities like Austin and Dallas were struggling to figure out how to deal with hundreds of electric scooters on their streets and sidewalks. Could it be that this issue of what to do about scooters will seem like a thing of the past? Joining us to talk about it is Omar Gayaga. He is our go-to tech guy here on the Standard. Omar, good to talk with you again.
Hey, David. Thank you for having me.
So, limes and birds and lifts and jumps. We're talking about scooter companies, and they have not been doing a brisk business of late for obvious reasons.
No. As people have stayed home and have been avoiding anything, you know, that requires touching objects, you've seen people steer clear of these. But what's interesting is that we were already starting to see some cracks in the facade of scooter companies even before all of this. We were already starting to see some companies go under and pull back, and you know, as far back as December and January. So this is clearly, you know, they are being affected by COVID-19. But I think there was some stuff going on even before that.
It's my understanding that a couple of the biggest here, Bird and Lime, have actually been laying off people across the country, including here in Texas.
Yeah, we've seen them reducing their workforces. We've seen them pulling out of some cities. Lyft pulled out its entire fleet of scooters from the city of Austin. So, wow. Yeah, we're definitely seeing things scale back as people just kind of avoid these devices. But then we're also seeing the companies promote that, you know, that they're doing sanitation and trying to make these safe rides. But these are also the companies that were flouting city ordinances for a long time before they got going, and that were having trouble even keeping scooters off of trails and busy sidewalks. So I don't know if you trust them to sanitize every single scooter after every single ride.
Notwithstanding that, I mean, there are other benefits I would imagine that scooter companies would love to talk about. They have you have this issue of social distancing, for example, probably better than some modes of public transportation. No?
Yeah, that is kind of what they're trying to come back with right now. They are actually some of them like Lime, which is very popular in some cities, is promoting free rides for public health personnel and law enforcement. Lime is doing a free 30-minute ride for first responders and people that need them in cities like Nashville, Oklahoma City, Dallas, and Austin. So they are trying to kind of get with the program and promote that they are providing these safe rides. But, you know, as people stay home, you just don't hear about these companies very much anymore. I mean, in 2018, I believe one of these companies was Inc. Company of the Year. and now they're struggling to stay in business.
Are any governments dealing with issues related to scooters right now? I guess it's pretty much 24/7 pandemic.
Yeah, it has been pretty busy. I mean, you hear it in drips and drabs. I mean, I heard in this week in San Marcos, they were actually banning scooters in public spaces, but they didn't specifically say that was related to coronavirus. But you can own a scooter and ride it in San Marcos, but they are banning the companies that are doing scooter rentals. And so, and that has just happened this week.
So what does all this add up to when it comes to the future of the scooter business, do you think, Omar?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think, we were already seeing predictions of kind of a shakeout in this business of some consolidation or some of these companies just going away. There were just too many scooters and too many scooter companies in a lot of cities. But now it's just a matter of whether people feel comfortable using them and how long they can sustain these businesses if people are just not using them at the same volume as before the COVID crisis.
Omar Gayaga tracks all things tech, wheeled or otherwise, over at TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, good to talk with you. Thank you so much and stay safe.
Thanks, David. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're going to be checking back in with Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, in, just a few minutes, about 20, 25 minutes or so. We'd love to know what's making news in your part of the Lone Star State, and you know what to do. Just look for us. Well, on Twitter, you could do that, right? You go to Texas, just hashtag Texas Standard or at Texas Standard. Or, of course, you could reach out to us by email, texasstandard@kut.org. Wells back in about 25.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Governor Greg Abbott is eliminating confinement as a punishment for violating local public health orders during the coronavirus pandemic. The order issued this morning comes in response to the case of a Dallas salon owner who's been jailed for keeping her business open during the outbreak. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and Attorney General Ken Paxton have also called for Shelley Luther's release. On Fox News Channel this morning, Paxton criticized the Dallas County judge for going too far with Luther's sentence.
I'm not saying that she shouldn't be held accountable for her actions. What I am saying is we've overreacted. This is not the way America's supposed to be. You're not supposed to be sitting in prison because you've tried to keep your business alive.
In a statement, Abbott says his order also retroactively applies to two women arrested in Laredo for violating public health orders. It's unclear if Luther will be released. The governor is allowing salons and barbershops across the state to reopen starting tomorrow. HEB and two other Texas-based grocery store companies are included in a nationwide federal lawsuit alleging price gouging during the public health crisis. The suit filed in Austin last week accuses more than a dozen businesses of nearly tripling the price of eggs after the governor declared a state of disaster in mid-March. Other companies named in the suit include Walmart, Costco, and Kroger. HEB, based in San Antonio, calls the allegations meritless. Other Texas companies implicated are Brookshire Grocery, founded in Tyler, and Lowe's Markets in Littlefield. Environmental groups in Texas are criticizing a new temporary rule allowing fossil fuel companies more leeway in storing oil and natural gas underground. The Texas Railroad Commission this week relaxed restrictions to permit underground storage in geological formations other than salt caverns. Emma Papst with the nonprofit group Environment Texas says salt caverns are typically used for storage to prevent hydrocarbons from contaminating aquifers and water supplies.
Now they can pull the oil and gas up out of the ground, put it through the processing process, and then put it right back in. The idea is that these oil companies can keep producing oil even in the midst of a shortage on places to store our oil and gas.
Fossil fuel storage capacity has been inundated since the oil market crashed due to weak demand amid the coronavirus pandemic. And Texas Governor Greg Abbott is heading to Washington, D.C. today to discuss the state's coronavirus response with President Trump. Vice President Mike Pence is also set to attend the discussion at the White House this afternoon. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. COVID-19 has disproportionately affected black and brown people in the United States. It's a potentially deadly outcome linked to economic and social disparities that have been around this country for a long time. It can be a bleak reality to examine. But a new book foregrounds the strength and resilience of the African-American community, and it may be just the message many would like to hear right now. Stacy DeFreitas is an associate professor at the University of Houston Downtown and the author of African-American Psychology, A Positive Perspective. Professor DeFreitas, thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell us a little bit about the messages in your text that might be helpful right now.
The main idea really is that African Americans have a lot of strengths that we are kind of ignoring and looking and overlooking. We are kind of focusing on a lot of the negative. And so I felt like it was really important in this book to look at some of the historical reasons why African Americans are struggling in some areas and look at some of the structural reasons, looking at things like racism, biases, other types of discrimination that are impacting African Americans, but also focusing on those strengths that African Americans have within the community to be resilient and rise above a lot of those barriers that they're experiencing.
Let's talk about those strengths more specifically. Mm-hmm. If you were to list, say, three right off the top, what would you point to?
I would look first at religion and spirituality. It's very common among African Americans and typically there are positive outcomes when African Americans have a strong relationship with either some sort of religion or even spiritual beliefs, right? They have positive health outcomes, academic outcomes, a variety of different areas. So religion is really a big one. Another important area I'd say is looking at family connection. And looking at the strength of kind of that communication between family members, relying on each other. It's really prominent among African Americans, as it is in other communities as well. But I think it's an important strength that we sometimes devalue or ignore, especially when we're looking at African American family structures. You hear a lot of people talking about single parent families and how the family system is weakening, but African American families are still very strong and rely on each other. I think another important area is really to look at the fact that African Americans in general are resilient, in that even though they have a lot of barriers in their way, a lot of times they push and they fight and they overcome those barriers, even though they know that things are hard and not fair and not equal, but they still want their lives to be good. They want their families, their friends' lives to be good. So they push through and make improvements.
Why is it, do you think, that these positive values and perspectives are hard to find in the sort of the popular narrative? Or am I jumping the gun there? Are they everywhere and we're just not paying attention?
You know, I think overall they are a little bit hard to find. I think there are a variety of reasons for that. If you look at the discipline of psychology in general, a lot of the focus isn't positive. In honesty, we're looking at problems from a perspective of psychology.
Right.
And that's why there's such a push for positive psychology anyway, because we're starting to see that we need to look at those things that make us better and not just focus on those things that are problems. But I think also there are so many stereotypes and negative views of African Americans that are perpetuated and pushed around. And if someone doesn't have a lot of experience with African Americans, doesn't have relationships with African Americans, they're likely to believe them. And so these ideas keep getting perpetrated throughout society, and we're not doing enough to combat them or fight against them.
I have to say that it almost seems as if this act of writing this book was a kind of an exercise in healing unto itself. I mean, it wasn't just talking about what is, but in a way, it seems like you're almost reaching out to the community in a sense.
That really was part of what I was doing. I felt like it was really important to get some of these ideas and messages out. And it's not just psychology. There's also history in it, because I feel like you can't understand what African Americans are facing today if you don't understand a lot of the history behind it. And I end the book with a chapter on the future that really looks at ways that we can continue to improve. So focusing on the strengths, but also looking at, well, where are these areas that the African American community really needs to dig in and make some improvements? And then how do we do that?
It is a fascinating read. It is African American Psychology, A Positive Perspective by Stacy DeFreitas. She's an associate professor at the University of Houston downtown. Professor DeFreitas, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
My name is Nathan Benavides. I'm the head choir director at Pascal High School in Fort Worth, Texas. We typically take a spring trip with our choir students every year, and this year we had a festival group reach out to us after seeing one of our YouTube performances, and they invited us to come sing at Carnegie Hall. Being invited to sing at Carnegie Hall is a huge deal, huge deal. It's such a hallmark venue for the country and really the world. The kids got their music in December and we were just getting ready to start working on it. Pretty excited about it when COVID hit us. So once the city of New York closed and forced Broadway to close, Carnegie closed, and that canceled our trip. You know, when things started to shut down, we were told that weekend to stay out of restaurants and going out. So two friends of mine decided to stay in and watch a movie. And lo and behold, one of the friends ended up getting sick the following day, came down with some symptoms, and got her positive results back a week later, and that was the same day that I got sick. You know, I think I probably was one of the first 50 cases in Tarrant County, but I'm not so sure. For me, it was just like being sick. Like, it, you know, you get the annual flu or you get an annual sinus infection. It was really bad headaches. Mild fevers at night, extreme fatigue, things that I would never have been able to do my job and go to work. I would have called in for the whole week. I was never concerned for my life. I never felt like I needed to go to the emergency room. So I was very fortunate that I think my symptoms were more mild in comparison to some of the most serious cases. So I've had really positive reactions by the community and the kids and their parents. And I've had kids check up on me. I've had families bring me food. So they've been very, very positive about it. So we've been doing once a week Zoom conferences with kids. We've been giving them music assignments that are mostly supposed to be somewhat music therapy, if you will. So they've been doing things like creating playlists that make them connect to their emotions and kind of explain how they're feeling while they're at home, or they've been composing their own music, or they've been singing karaoke to some of the songs that make them feel good. And we've been trying to find things that could inspire them in spite of the fact that they're not with us as a group. We have been brainstorming what choir and fine art performances for our students across the country might look like going forward. Choir is designed to be shoulder to shoulder, hand to hand, breathing together in unison. And COVID-19 is kind of putting that whole process into question. My name is Nathan Benavides. I'm the head choir director at Pasco High School, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. With college campuses shut down due to the coronavirus outbreak, most students have returned home. Not so easy for international students, though. Rob Upchurch spoke with some of them about being here when they wished they were there.
Sarah Al-Harbi is a doctoral candidate studying how to design curriculum for children at the University of North Texas.
Everyone is saying, go back, go back, go back. You don't know what's coming up, and the numbers are going higher.
She plans to finish her dissertation and graduate in May. But due to mounting pressure from friends and family, she says she might be celebrating the occasion at home in Saudi Arabia.
I don't know what's the future. I don't know. I didn't expect this ending after 8 years, and I consider myself like I also belong to this land as a Saudi Arabia because I've been here 8 years.
While Al-Harbi can work from home and the university has been flexible with her research, other students are having their studies more directly affected. Dongni Xia, who's from China, teaches piano to music students while earning her doctorate in music performance at UNT.
We currently not teaching the normal class online right now because the practice rooms are closed because we don't want students to go to the practice buildings to practice. And a lot of people, they don't have access to a keyboard or a piano at home, so they cannot practice.
She says the minor delay from a Zoom call makes it hard to teach lessons in real time. Instead, she has to work with students in new ways.
For students who have piano at home, so I'm meeting them individually through Zoom. I will give them tasks and they send me back the video and I will grade them.
Shia says isolation is nothing new to a lifelong musician, so not much has changed for her.
Honestly, I haven't felt that much big difference in my life because as a musician, I spend most of time by myself practicing in the practice room. So I don't really go out to bars or for entertainment a lot. So even when everything is shut down, I don't really feel that my world is closed.
Jennifer Cowley, Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs at UNT, oversees students' academic and professional success. Right now, that means helping students adjust to the realities of the pandemic. Cowley says most of UNT's international students are choosing to stay in the area while they continue their classes. But students who are graduating, like Al-Harbi, are unsure of what to do when their visa status changes.
By August, or let's say September, I should be out of the United States. By anyhow, in their normal situation. My visa's done. I need to be out.
Al-Harbi has the added challenge of looking after her parents. They came to Texas in early March ahead of commencement ceremonies. But then graduation events were canceled and air travel restrictions began, leaving them stuck in Denton for now. Al-Harbi says the extra family time is nice, but it's making it hard for her to finish her dissertation.
I usually stop studying, I go out, sit with them, and try to make them feel better about the situation. I feel responsible somehow for the lid down.
International and domestic students will be eligible to live on campus throughout the summer, if necessary. Cowley says the university is working on solutions for students who plan to start their education in the fall. Meanwhile, Al-Harbi is doing her best to stay calm.
It's not like wars or something where you can blame someone for whatever you're in. It's just we have no one to blame. That's it.
I'm Rob Upchurch in Denton.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It was the sound of the scissors heard across Texas Tuesday in an act of apparent civil disobedience. State Representative Steve Toth and Briscoe Kane took their seats and some selfies in a Houston salon to send a message to fellow Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Texans want to get haircuts now. Before the afternoon was over, Governor Abbott announced salons and barbershops would be reopening with limited service on Friday. That's tomorrow, days earlier than the governor had previously signaled, the Texas Tribune reported. Well, some Texans may be ready for the clippers, but what about those doing the clipping? Ron Jemison is presiding officer with the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation Advisory Board on Barbering, and he is the owner of Franklin Barbering Institute in Houston. Mr. Jemison, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
I think most of this state was expecting salons and barbershops to open next week on the 18th. Did this new reopening date catch the barbershops and salons off guard?
A little bit. When we heard the announcement the other day, everybody kind of just hoorahed and chimed in together that we're back in. And I think it kind of made everybody buckle down and understand it's serious. So we got to make sure everybody's buildings are up to par and ready to go.
But now you don't have to reopen.
Right.
I'm sure that some folks in the business must be a little troubled about the spread of the virus, no?
I mean, it's kind of mixed emotions. You have the people that just graduated maybe from a barber school and just maybe got their license. They're ready to go and they don't want to take a day off because they're building their clientele. And then you have the people that's been in the business for a very long time that kind of understand the piece of putting your money up and saving for a rainy day. It kind of puts a lot of uncertainty in people's minds, and so your precautionary is to stay closed until more information is released.
For those who decide to open on Friday,
mm-hmm.
it's
mm-hmm.
kind of hard to cut a person's hair 6 feet away. and of course, what about mask wearing and that kind of thing? Is there any sort of direction from the TDLR?
Yes. So state, what we've done is sent out guidelines yesterday, and there'll be some more going out today. The first set of guidelines pretty much kind of let barbershops and salons know what they're going to need to address to their clients and to their staff. And so everybody must wear masks. They're going to be taking appointments, so there won't be a waiting area. People will be buzzed in, kind of like a restaurant when you go in and it's crowded, and you get a little beeper, and you stand outside and wait for your number to be called. The difference is you'll be outside in your car. And I think that you know, with limiting the amount of people in your building, I know it's a contact business, and it's very hard for a customer to wear a mask when you're getting a shave. So I think at that point with the barber or the stylist wearing a mask, you know, they're going to be very careful. I think the industry already practices a very good line of sanitation. It's just going to make people accountable. And I think it's a good thing for our industry as well.
What about the shortages in personal protective equipment, PPE?
Right.
Are there enough masks to go around?
I think now we're starting to see a influx of PPE material or things of that nature. And also, I've seen a lot of barbers and stylists coming up with their own methods. I think plexiglass might have went up.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah,
might have went up because people are very creative, man. And that's one thing about our industry. They're artists. We're seeing a lot of innovative things that people are coming up with to make sure they protect the clients and themselves. And so I think that it's going to be a good move. And I think that people are going to really be shocked of the ability to protect them and the also protect the actual stylist and barber.
You sound more excited than full of fear and trepidation, I must say.
I actually am. I saw a lot of people lose their way of supporting their family. To see that, it really saddened me. I understand life and death. I do. And, you know, so the main thing, of course, that we're concerned with is making sure everybody's safe. And that's something that we do on a daily basis anyway. The longer we stayed out, you know, you saw people actually calling me, asking me if I wanted to buy their salon. You know, those things were really kind of eating at me a lot because of the simple fact that I know that this is the only way that they can survive is to, you know, perform these duties. And I did not see a lot of people on air and on media not being groomed. You know, it sent a different shockwave through our industry. You know, it was like, whoa, so you got a haircut. You were able to cut somebody's hair for $100, but I can't cut anybody's hair.
Ron Jemison is presiding officer with the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation Advisory Board on Barbering, and he is the owner of Franklin Barbering Institute in Houston. Mr. Jemison, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, so I was listening to Mr. Jemison talk about how people in media have gotten their hair trimmed. I'm a little in need there. I'm glad we're doing this on radio, not on television. I must say.
I am fortunate to be quarantined with a excellent hairstylist, so I do have that going for me. Yeah,
nice.
All this hair talk, lots of talk about hair. New developments in a story I was talking about yesterday. We heard about this some in the newscast. That's the story of the Dallas salon owner who was arrested and sentenced to a week in jail. It's attracted the attention of the governor, the attorney general, lots of attention from the right, trained on one Shelley Luther, the salon owner who kept her business open in defiance of local officials. Greg Abbott altered his executive order, arguing it applies retroactively to her case and that she should not be jailed. Attorney General Ken Paxton additionally calling the arrest an overreach. Another aspect to this, judges on the ground in Dallas calling Paxton's call to release Luther an overreach of its own. Yesterday, 12 civil district judges in Dallas County signed a letter stating that Paxton's actions encouraging a judge to release her violated Texas codes of judicial conduct and adding it was contrary to the concept of an independent judiciary. We'll share the letter there on our Twitter page shortly. On our Facebook page, Meg Hertz says, do the crime, do the time. The judge did his job upholding the governor's executive order. She calls it no act of civil disobedience, but merely an act of impudence. Just one reaction we're seeing on the story that's really beginning to attract some national attention there, David.
Seeing some listeners also responding to some breaking news. It appears that Neiman Marcus has formally filed for bankruptcy, and some people, some listeners, say talking about Neiman Marcus in terms of an epitaph for the luxury goods retailer. As it happens, this is not a liquidation of Neiman Marcus.
Right.
What this does is this will restructure their debt load, and they say they will be back in business as soon as this whole COVID-19 thing passes.
Yeah, formally filing for those Chapter 11 protections. Got this great tweet from one of our listeners, Lip Rap. She writes, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Who will step up with a bonkers holiday catalog now? Referring there to the famous Neiman's catalog. And again, as you just noted, David, it's important to note that this doesn't mean the end of the company. But obviously, Chapter 11 proceedings, not carrying a very good omen for business. You could say, but
never
obviously, yes, things like Neiman's, just the sort of the opulence of it. Things like these. What do we got? What does she mention here in her tweets? Burgundy Humvees, end zones from the old Texas Stadium. The crazy things you could find in their holiday catalog.
Yeah,
good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
There.
I think they will probably be issuing another catalog. So never fear, those of you who like to thumb through it. Listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast. We're going to be back here tomorrow. In the meantime, check out the news over at TexasStandard.org. I'm Dave Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.